Right, okay, yeah.
I just jotted down a few things that I hope both speakers would be able to address. Firstly, of course, the thing that differentiated Morris's view, that there was no money. And they laughed about the idea that there would be money. It became a joke throughout the whole narrative. The second thing I'd like to do is, some of my comrades will know this, but I have a great definition of utopia, which I got from a fellow speaker in Hyde Park called Philip. And here he has his banner, which says at the top in big letters, Utopia, and then underneath says, could be the answer to some of your problems. Let me explain. I think first of all, I'm happy as a member of the Socialist Party to be described as utopian, and I'll give the reasons why. First of all, I think there is an enormous role to be played in moving on in society by the imagination we have about how we could move on. And that is a crucial element when we look at things. It's not just theoretical. But the other thing is that there is a common denominator in all of people's views of utopia. And that is that every one of them depends upon the human cooperation. And so why I would say I was unashamedly utopian, because it seems to be a simple proposition. As a socialist, I believe in the unlimited potential of human consciousness to change and adapt. That makes me utopian, because all utopias depend upon that change. If you put a limit to that, if you take a more negative view about human capacity, then you cannot ever be utopian in that sense. What would be regarded as utopia, in my view, would be a universal desire to have and work in a society of harmony and cooperation. If that desire exists, then, of course, but then utopia, of course, it isn't static. That is the problem with trying to make a fixed view of it. And, of course, we see in our society the enormous influence and pressures and determinism of economics, but the fact is that in a utopia you can't have anything fixed, you can't have a fixed plan, and you change every day or it ceases to be utopia. So basically that's what I say, that having that absolute confidence, whether we survive long enough to see it come to fruition, in the capacity for human change and adaptation through our inquisitive and natural creativity, I say that makes me a utopian.
Yeah, I think it does. Do you want us to?
If you want to.
Or other people could join.
And if you feel like you want to.
That's all right. Well, imagination, of course, is a marvellous thing. And we've often said that the reason that people haven't properly turned against war is because they don't have imagination. Otherwise, you know, I can't imagine why anyone should acquiesce in it. As for whether you're a utopian or not, in a sense, of course, I don't mind what you call it, so long as you work for it. Yes. Call it socialism, call it what you will. Common ownership, production solely for use. Yes, it's not thought of, not proposed to be an ideal perfection or whatever, but in contrast to what we have now, well, wouldn't we have a party? You know, wouldn't we feel, well, really, we have got somewhere. Really, we have achieved something. No one in the world going hungry on the horrible end. No one being killed. No one having their crops destroyed. And going further along, no one having their lives stunted by how they've had to earn a living, by how they've had to struggle, by what life has done to them. Not perfection, but my goodness, streets away from what we have now. And if your imagination can bring that up and help you sort of get the enthusiasm to work for it, well, fair enough. Yeah.
There was a point in what I was just thinking about how adaptable and creative humans are. And I think we live at a point in time where, I suppose, we shine quite brightly with what we're capable of and our skills and intelligence and insight and a knowledge of the universe, perhaps from an overly scientific perspective. So that's human capability, isn't it? But then we don't want to give up on that. But at the same time, there seems to be a shift of what is seen as worth doing as we go into the future. You know, it seems to be this endless progression to what, you know, to what's, which is also just a continuation. I don't think the continuation needs to shift from what is seen as progression towards something else. Progression needs to be seen as something other than what it's seen as. I think that's my point. If that is understandable.
Yes.
The direction we're all faced in, and they want us to keep looking towards, is the future and how we progress. But what, how we progress is the question, because we've got the knowledge to actually live different lives. So in a way, we don't need to progress much more in the way that, I don't know, it's a kind of uncertain.
It's a problem, isn't it? Capitalism has told us that unless we grow and grow and adapt and progress, we'll be going backwards.
From education.
We've all got slightly to think about that. Going backwards, bad.
I mean, I suppose going back, but we're kind
static.
Of...
Static bad.
Because capitalism needs growth. If enterprises aren't growing, they're falling behind. They're competing, and they've got to all the time be going forward. And a lot of progress is what I call sideways. I don't think that human beings, the sort of imagination wanting to do things would come to a stop with the end of capitalism, but it wouldn't be this sort of what I call a perversion of progress, where you've got to manufacture wants and you've got to have people dissatisfied with the particular thing that they've got. And they've got to have the latest one because it tickles up and does something. And, oh, my goodness, look how quick this one goes. And, oh, my goodness, this one's much quicker. Let's move on to that. And that kind of progress, I think, is a perversion of what is actually needed. The kind of thing when we're perfectly capable. We've got everything to give people a good life. If someone still wants to... make progress with these things and make changes, well, that's fine, but it won't be the pushing that there has been now. It's got to be sold, you've got to compete, and if there's not a job for you, well, hard luck, you know, you can't have these things because they cost money, and that's the perversion that we need to finish.
Yeah, I'd say the progress needed is the sort of progress in maybe... one could call it lateral thinking, where we're actually, you know, progressing in the sense of the conception of our own happiness. You know, that latest gadget isn't going to make you happy because there'll be another one they're trying to sell you in the future. So, you know, it's about human relationships and how we're relating to each other as a species, and, you know, the psychology of that needs to progress more than anything, you know, that connectedness.
Yes, I think that's right. And I think that capitalism has got nothing particular to do with that. If one did away with capitalism, we would still have a highly unfair, exploitative system. And if the socialist vision is one of justice, the issue of scarcity, we know, we need not live, no one need be in scarcity. But we're in a world of humans treating each other unjustly, which is nothing to do with capitalism, but goes back at least to the beginning of cities and to the times when there were kings, pharaohs, priests, and so on. And this vision calls all of that into question. So that I think it's necessary to be talking about hierarchy generally rather than simply capitalism or simply industrialisation.
Did I say something? Well, it's quite true, of course. War predates capitalism. Poverty predates capitalism. The treatment of women predates capitalism. But that doesn't mean that it isn't capitalism which stands in the way of making the change now. That doesn't mean that it isn't capitalism that is the present cause of the problem. That production is geared to sale and profit. And it's not a question of looking at what we need, what would be the best sort of thing to have here. It's the question of what to sell. And you hear it all the time when you're saying, well, what this country has got to do, and we've got to compete. We've got to compete with China. We've got to compete with Europe. We've got to have this airport, another runway here, because otherwise the passengers are going there and they're getting the money from this growth that we are not getting. It is capitalism that stands in the way. Now, why would socialism be different? Because the production for sale and a profit would be gone. Production would be solely for use. We would simply be making things that human beings need. And there would be have to be consensus about what would be the things that are needed. And if there are shortages of some things, it will be dealt with in a common sense way.
Do you think that we've got... The problem is, we've got what we need. We've got everything we need. What do we need to invent that we don't need?
Socialists.
All right, so you're basically, you know, we've got the stuff, haven't we?
Yeah, yes, well, you're right.
We don't need to make any more.
No.
We just need to use them, repair them and share and get on.
There are parts of the world where they don't have enough. So that there would need to be consideration of whether within their area they can remedy that, or whether it has to be coordination, has to be world coordination, and there would be probably an initial time where more of stuff did have to be produced to make sure that everyone had the clean water, the sanitation, the basic things, and by basic, of course. It doesn't just mean, entertainment is part of basic needs and so on. But to have but you see what I mean. I'm not saying that everyone's got to just have the minimum, but to have everyone have the satisfactory thing. No, you wouldn't need to keep on making things. I mean, why would you? Things do wear out, of course, and things have to be repaired, but things can be made to last as long as possible. And
it's the reality that if we suddenly stopped producing all this stuff and thinking that we need to invent something else to help us do it, that actually people will be like out of jobs and won't have any worse than that, is that they won't know what to do with themselves. Yes. So they don't know how to spend time being alive.
Oh, that's what I was told at school. It's a lie.
Yes.
Yes.
That's my slight worry about what you were saying. All these ticket collectors. Oh, it used to be ticket collectors. Now it's ticket machines and people going to work in banks or call centres or to things with regard as rather useless or exploitative. What are they all going to be doing? Because we don't need them all in the factories for sure. And
a few years ago they were sort of talking as though it was going to be a problem, then people are never going to get all these jobs back, and what are they going to be doing? It didn't happen within capitalism. But there will be things to do. There will be more people to do useful work, and there are jobs now which may be done by machinery that people might better enjoy doing. It doesn't mean that you can do without the mass production. production, of course, because you've got an enormous world population to deal with. But there may be some things that can be done like that. Well, someone even suggested we could take turns at work. You can book up a time for working, and as one of our comrades goes on about, well, people would only need to work 2 days. Well, I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. And he says, well, you could spend your time going on a sailing boat to Australia. Well, rather him than me, but there we are.
Richard?
I think one of the things we've got to bear in mind about capitalism, it was the first time that it made a promise that it could solve these problems. Mm. It could produce enough, it could feed the world. And in fact, in reality, the mechanics of the system, it can't do any of the things it promised. And in the meantime, unfortunately, there's been a widespread acceptance that it's the end of history, it's immutable, it cannot be changed. I do not accept the idea that people will be walking around bored out of their minds. I'm 80 next year. There's hundreds of thousands of books I haven't read, thousands of pieces of music, thousands of walks I haven't done, thousands of people I want to talk to, thousands of jobs I could do. I mean, it's only in your mind you're bored, and I think that is the worst thing that's happened in our society. It dulled people's mind because financial security is the only security they're made to believe in. And instead of stepping back from the rat race and saying we don't need all this, and the heart of the problem is as the knowledge, our knowledge of science and industry and technology increases, alas, our wisdom of how to apply it and how to live diminishes.
David?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the beauty of capitalism is it's handed us a key, because it expanded the means of production. It has given us an enormous potential to meet human need. The contradiction is, of course, it can never actually satisfy that need, because it's continually having to make profits. So it's continually having to persuade us to consume rubbish or to keep other people in poverty and destroy their means of production through one war after another. I think that I don't actually see a major problem with leisure time. Somebody said to me years ago that what was such a good idea, the rich could kept it for themselves. In fact, it's exactly the opposite. You know, I think that the interesting thing about, say, education system is that we're constantly being told, oh, you know, the economics, we need more scientists, we need this, that. Let's gear the children, let's educate the children to feed the means of production. And actually, I think if we can relieve children of that burden, and there's a super book that I read many years ago, A.S. Neil wrote Summerhill, which, and he believed in free education, giving children choices, believing that all knowledge is interlinked, and all you have to do is tap into children's potential, because they are so switched on for learning. And something happens as we go through the educational system where gradually we turn children off, and they usually can't wait to get out. One of the examples he says in Summerhill is that he believed that most people spent their leisure time passively, like thousands of people turning up at football matches to watch, you know, 22 other people kick a ball about. And they thought, well, why? And he believed it was because when children would be preferring to kick a ball, we keep them locked up in a classroom. Giving children a certain amount of freedom vis-a-vis their education, they will be able to kick a ball to their heart's content. They will prefer to actually play games rather than watch games being played. That they do not have to project their stymied childhood ambitions and fantasies onto heroes, onto stars. You can see a new kind of person, someone who's actually active and creative, someone who's not a passive consumer. And it is quite, it is a, it is a, the idea of imagination. We've actually got to take a leap and say, look at research in children. Look how keen they are. First set of stats on year two, suddenly the classroom changes. And so, as we march them through, we are moulding to couch potato, whatever. Certainly, lots of the medical problems we're picking up now, you know, with obesity and all the rest of it. Passive. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be swept away.
Well, I was just thinking about the use of the word passive. Has it not always been a negative word?
Okay, so I guess we'll reconvene. Who wants to make any... Yeah?
I got a question for Barbara, and excuse me if I missed something because I came in a little late, but it's really about the development of the usage of the word. I mean, you know, we all know now that it was invented, we probably knew before, it was invented by Moore, but it has a particular meaning now, connoting being unrealistic and also being implying a blueprint in detail. Can you say something about... It does seem to me that negative kind of usage was probably developed by people who were conservative and therefore against the... You were talking about the challenging nature, weren't you? How did the usage develop? Do you know?
I'm thinking there's a quotation from Edmund Burke in his book Against the French Revolution, 1793 or whenever that was, whenever he wrote it, I mean, where he says something like at the end of every utopian vista, I see the gallows. So he was a conservative, of course, and even so, it might have been that the French Revolution itself in 1789 got associated with utopianism, ideal blueprints, radical change, and that sort of thing, and became anathema to conservatives as early as that. As I said, in the late 20th, second half of the 20th century, people like Popper and Talman and Hayek are writing about utopianism, associating it with Nazi Germany and Stalin's Russia, and saying, well, look what this led to. Utopian equals authoritarian. It's an overwhelming ideology. It's a dominant figure, a leader figure, and this, that, and the other. And so it got a very bad press from then on, I think. But I haven't traced the... many ways in which it's been used pejoratively, but those are two that come to mind immediately. Some of us are trying to revive the positive connotations of utopianism, which I hope was what I was doing here.
Okay, Jacqueline's got a question, and probably should we do a collection as well?
Oh, I hope not. I haven't got to do the collection as well, have I?
No.
No, well, unless you want to.
Thank you very much for coming and giving us a lovely talk. Oh, I've heard Pat, and I know she always gives a good one, but thank you, Barbara, for coming here. Back to the utopians, though. How you've used the word there for socialists, utopian socialists. Me, today, I look at the left of the political spectrum, you know, the right, the left, the centre, the Greens, charities, all these people who are putting all their energies into trying to make capitalism work in the interests of the majority population rather than the few who own everything. They surely are the utopians in any sense that you want to call it. They've got no chance of changing capitalism or even making an impact on it. You know, for all the margins, all the rest of what's gone on. Have you got anything, do you have anything to say on that, either of you? I've given you anything to work on.
Practical utopians, as it were. Would you call them more than idealist. I mean,
well, you've heard the Green Party, a fair wage, a living wage, all this nonsense. Yeah, yeah. You know, okay. Money again, and you know.
I think, if I might say what I think comes out of that, you take Hayek, for instance. I always, when I debated with the free marketeers, said they're more utopian than we are, because they believe in a change of consciousness, but there'll still be money and exploitation.
Yes.
Mm. I think that's more or less what...
Thank you, Richard.
Yeah. Mm. And in a way, that is true, isn't it?
I have to say I've never used the word, I've never thought much about the word utopian, but I've never used it in that sense as...
in the negative sense.
..of criticising these well-meaning people or whatever who think they can make some changes now that they can't do.
Well, the reason I said that was because in those debates, they always accused us socialists of being utopian and impossible. And I pointed out merely that if we were impossible, when we wanted a cooperative society without any trappings, what were they when they wanted to preserve what was there already going wrong and still have a utopian society? Far more difficult to achieve.
A nicer capitalism.
I think there's a sort of spectrum between having a few ideals and actually becoming a fully fledged utopian who's got some sort of blueprint in their head. Maybe, you know, maybe members of the SPGB are in that sense utopian, because they have, as you were saying, Pat, you know, you've got quite a strong programme of all the things that would be implemented, not just one or two small changes. It's a radical reversing upheaval of society, and that's kind of fully fledged utopianism, as opposed to thinking a bit of reform and a bit more redistribution would be a good jolly nice thing.
Well, I suppose I don't mind if you call it utopian, I'm really giving a fully fledged, all that we can do is give the basis for how things would be done differently because of the common ownership and true democracy, because you can't really have democracy unless you have economic equality. In other words, if everyone has the same relationship to the means of production, then you can have democratic decision-making. But I can't, or we can't set forward a plan of how things... should be done. I mean, we have a pamphlet, it's Socialism as a Practical Alternative, and it's tentative. It says, well, this is how things could be done, this is how things could be organised, but obviously a minority now with the ideas cannot tell a majority of the world's population how they want to organise things. I mean, organisation may be slightly different in different regions. They may approach it from a different way, but with that common objective and with the worldwide coordination and cooperation instead of this awful competition that you have now.
Yeah.
David?
Maybe a couple of points. One is that we can get hung up in terminology. I mean, we talk about progress, but it's progress to where? What is our objective? So if your objective, in a sense, is an ideal, then everyone else who doesn't agree with you is a utopian. And it, that cuts both ways. The other one, to give an example of that, is I've been told it's out of print, but Louise Bernelli, some years ago, wrote a book called Journey Through Utopia, and I mean, she was an anarchist criticising all the utopian thinkers and the utopian books, saying that they're all highly authoritarian and all we're trying to do is fit the people to a wheel, stretch them into what their ideal. So it's highly authoritarian, whereas of course they could turn around and say, but what have you got to offer? You're the idealist, you're the utopian. So
I think what we've got to do is kind of, in a sense, define our terms. I mean, I think that, by that I mean define where we want to progress to. I mean, what I actually think is that in terms of capitalism, if we don't progress or evolve, might be a better word, towards socialism, then we may end up with extinction, because capitalism is making a terrible mess.
Mm.
You know, arguably, we just cannot go on like this.
And perhaps you could say more about a wageless society with no money.
You were directing that, yeah, Pat, yeah.
Yeah, well...
Both of you.
Yes, right, I'll go first. Yes, it's extraordinary the hold that sort of money has, and right from infancy, a small child learns that can't have anything without the money, and you get to children get sort of hung up on looking through catalogues and seeing a grandchild who his mum would sort of get the catalogue out of the way. You can't spend your time looking at what can be got. So how do we deal without money, without a wageless society? It's almost like this sort of like this anchor, that is so pervasive for you, absolutely through every sort of every sphere that nothing happens. It's almost as though it's money that builds houses and money that plants corn and money that digs it up and money that does, but it doesn't. It's human labour applied to natural raw materials, and that in a society without money, that's what will happen. Human beings will do the jobs that need doing and have to be organised, but you don't need money to be organised. You need people. You have all sorts of clever means of communications and now when you go to a supermarket and they make that awful buzz every time and things, but they know exactly what's going out and what needs to come in, right? So we can use it. We don't have the money part of it, but we can have the technology that there is that counts things and assesses what's needed and the same sort of thing. Someone's going to build something, they're going to work out what materials they need, the same as they do now, except that they haven't got to go and buy what they need to do it. They have that. They can go and get what they need to do it. Again, there's got to be organisation. You've got to know. You've got to know what's got to be taken to where and what's happening, so that you don't run out of something because there's been what in capitalism would be called a run on it. But human beings will make these decisions. We'll use the technology that we've got, and that's what they will do. It will be human beings applied to the raw materials without that money, without that awful sort of shackle that's sitting upon us and chaining us down to what happens now.
Can I add something to that? I mean, I think once you've got the wageless society where everyone's basic needs are satisfied, or perhaps more than sufficiently satisfied, there'll still be things that are going to be in short supply, and I would say it would be desirable to have some sort of money system. You can call it money, or you can call it coupons or whatever you like, to distribute rarities. I don't know, tickets at the theatre where we can't all get in. We can't kind of redistribute the theatre, so we all go and spend at least 2 minutes to see the best play. But so there'll be some need for a kind of redistribution of the less necessary things of life, or not a distribution of less necessary things of life by some kind of system, unless we want to abolish anything that is scarce, so that, which would, I think, cut out some rather nice parts of life, like,
Sorry.
Well, I was just thinking in terms of the use of land, and because that's quite a rigid control. And actually, some of the places that are, countryside, there's nobody out there these days, hardly. these are places that are out. So I just wondered what attitudes towards sort of land and space and the use of land.
Sorry,
feature in the kind of changed future.
Can I say more, a bit more added on to that?
Okay.
Is that to Marx said that even Labour time vouchers will be needed initially, but then you said because of an over, it wasn't necessary anymore to have a Labour time voucher, so we could go straight to socialism. And you're on about plays and things like that. Well, I mean, we could put hundreds of plays on because there'd be too many people, wouldn't there? Exactly. Nobody wants to.
There's a photocopy of a Labour time voucher. I think the example that Barbara gave of tickets at a theatre, well, what a lovely example, you know, of what we might have trouble with, but as someone said, we, you know, have lots of plays. And I remember lots and lots of years ago, I think before I was even a member of the party, and but talking about socialism, and the objection that someone that I was working with made, well, everyone will want to see the best performers, you know, what are you going to do about it? And then you think that all of going on in the world, and this is the problem that they come up with, you know, that you do. But I mean, it isn't a problem. It is, you know, surely that how many years has this play that's just come off musical been running? 24 years. Well, goodness me, you know, no problems. We can run the play for enough years until everyone's seen it that wants to see it. No, but if there, you know, things change about what is things that are thought of as being I can't think of the word. What used to happen with say we used to only have chicken at Christmas, and now that you know you have lots that sort of thing, the scarce thing changes, and oysters used to be, you know, for the food of the poor until they become scarce, and these things. But that kind of problem about shortage, I think we can take turns. I mean, surely, you know, if that is the kind of problem, bring it on, you know, and we'll take turns or whatever, but let's deal with these other terrible problems.
I'd like to raise a question to both speakers that following this rapid change of the fundamentals of society, that in the short term there would be quite a lot of people in financial professions that would be out of work. I mean, presumably you could still funnel them into jobs in middle management or things like logistics chains or warehouses and things like that they may be suited for, but they will still carry with them their preconceived dispositions about wealth, class and poverty, along with education and culture. Do you think that these kind of elements may undermine the system?